Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The noted British writer and poet W.H. Auden said in a famous speech at a fundraiser for exiles fleeing from future dictator Francisco Franco's victory in the Spanish Civil War in 1939, at the cusp of World War II, that intellectuals had become, quote, so damned selfish and lazy, unquote, and exhorted his listeners to behave more like small-d Democrats in their private lives. If we don't, he said, it will be our own people who will say, to hell with talk, to hell with truth, to hell with freedom, and will rise up and sweep us away. And by God, ladies and gentlemen, we shall deserve it. That might help explain why Donald Trump took the oath for president instead of Bernie Sanders, who is a real populist, but was torpedoed by the intellectual elites of the Democratic Party, who had chosen their own favorite, whom they would not relinquish despite popular acclaim. The superior intellects at the top of the Democratic Party did not anticipate the populist explosion sparked by Bernie Sanders. They remained unwavering in their chosen candidate, determined that she would be the first woman president, which they had planned 8 years earlier, but ran up against Barack Obama. Sanders was also unwavering in his one-issue campaign, as critics dismissed it, which he articulated years ago as the only socialist in Congress. If democracy is going to survive in this country, he said, tens of millions of poor and working class people are going to have to see the connection between their economic condition and the political process. They must vote not for the lesser of two evils, but for jobs, income, health care, and the dignity which they, as human beings, are entitled. Only when that occurs will American democracy become revitalized. The self-acclaimed Democratic intelligentsia was determined to sabotage Sanders' campaign. Perhaps release of the Russian files might reveal just how much they misread the populist surge that Sanders inflamed. The jackass party leadership should have had the sense to realize that Bernie Sanders had captured the hearts and minds of Americans who felt abandoned by the American dream. And although he did not single out and specify what is being called identity politics, he meant everybody deserved an even break. And they were insensitive to the fire that Sanders had started. He inflamed a bona fide populism ready to make serious changes in a society that impaired and left destitute millions of its citizens. But the party elite had a separate script and refused to modify it for the opportunity to truly meet public demand. Millions of ordinary citizens responded to Sanders' call and thronged his campaign stops. He had rekindled a fire of true populism that has burned sporadically ever since the revolution. Massive crowds gathered at his appearances all over the country, more than Trump ever garnered. In Portland, a small bird landed on his podium and became an icon for his campaign. Bernie Sanders lit the fire for real populism that Donald Trump confiscated and twisted into his own malignant, hate-filled platform when he realized that the Democratic leadership was thwarting Sanders' candidacy in favor of a preferred candidate. Of course, it is long past for a woman to be president, but even though Hillary Clinton got the popular vote after Sanders was abandoned, she did not especially resonate with discarded working-class Americans. So they turned to Donald Trump, which might suggest why so many white women, perhaps holding their noses, voted for him. Trump got the message and larded his nightmarish political savagery with a specious white supremacist perversion of populism that scapegoats the country's problems on blacks, immigrants, and the mainstream media. And the venal and unscrupulous, self-besotted Trump snatched the flame of populism and ran with it to the White House, declaring a blustery guerrilla warfare on the decorum of American politics. He aroused the worst instincts of the populist cause, virulently manipulating economic despair with nativist racism and malevolent nationalism. Trump declared his inauguration as National Patriotic Devotion Day. And this has been sort of a prologue that I wrote to something else I have written. So I should give a disclaimer that this program today is my opinion and mine only, perhaps anywhere, though I sincerely doubt it. I'll start with Small D Democracy, which I wrote. We are a democracy, yet we know little about democracy. Sovereignty, independence, and equal rights do not come easily and never stay very long without constant feeding and nurturing. It took time for people to be convinced of the possibility of freedom, even though our predecessors inherited a powerful but thwarted tradition of rights and liberties. Our own revolution was, in fact, the result of bitter disappointment the mother country did not recognize the loyalty to ancient principles its colonies in North America felt they had exhibited in resisting what they considered illegal and proscriptive edicts intolerable to honest and loyal subjects. We have evolved to world supremacy in hardly more than two centuries since the revolution, which has been the ambition all along, despite fearful and protective tendencies toward isolation. A history of the United States is not entirely an evolution of democracy, but more essentially its rise as a superpower, the world's only at present. As a nation that holds as its centerpiece distrust of military-inspired governance, even the conservative NRA rants that only citizens' rifles stand between tyranny and freedom. The USA has consistently turned to military solutions to resolve its ambitions. Despite its own demonstrated ruthlessness in world affairs, the US hasn't been as bad as some, Hitler and Stalin, Syria and ISIS. Yet to those it has attempted to yoke, it is bad enough. U.S. ambitions have killed or abandoned to political bondage millions of people whose only offense has been in the way of superpower supremacy. Peasant soldiers forced to arms to protect puppet regimes against domestic reform and insurrection. Whole populations caught in the thresher of abstract power that is gained at the expense of their expendability. Yet democracy incites ever-increasing numbers despite the brutal response of American puppets, and despite its own callous repression of libertarian movements, covertly or overtly, the U.S. is often the model of independence sought by indigenous rebels. If the U.S. really intends to democratize the world, it must first quit exploiting and treating as less than equal the people who live in other places. That would require acting as if Americans really do believe in democracy. We have been sleepwalking through history the past few decades, filling our pockets and amusing ourselves to death while most of the rest of the world burned in sweeping cycles of poverty and tragedy, often by the heavy hand of our superpower mandates that have allowed us an artificially inflated lifestyle we arrogantly call the American way of life. The response to 9/11 was out of proportion to what we have as a nation and a people identified with that nation done to other nations and peoples nearly everywhere in the world. Our leaders claim that our position of power mandates that we are the police force of an unsettled and violent world, but that claim does not justify acting internationally in a similar manner as domestic police in black sections of American cities, which in itself is obviously totally unjustified. The USA probably should, as so many suggest, refresh itself in this dark period of crises and uncertainty with a fresh infusion of original principles. But these are incredibly problematic to pin down and apply to an evolving millennial society. What is called original intent is too often contended to be the rule of propertied white men, which is not quite what the original framers had in mind. Instead, they had the foresight to recognize that the interests and problems, of succeeding generations would most certainly be different than their own. The Bill of Rights and subsequent amendments clarify that the original intent was not as restricted as so-called strict reconstructionists claim, but instead as originally constructed, an amendable document able to reflect and serve a continually changing civilization, despite the hardships, frustrations, and bloodshed that accompanies the amending process. And it must always be remembered that our first patriots were traitors and terrorists, insistently, relentlessly, and violently in revolt for freedom and independence. The endless cycle of individual rights and obligations melding within collective necessities is distinctly at play in this period of trauma and crisis. It is a time to confront and attempt to comprehend at their core the most cherished vanities, theories, philosophies, and moral roots of our civilization at their most vulnerable levels, in particular, the faltering myth that the wishes of the citizens could turn government around. The U.S. has seldom been kind or generous to its own poor or minorities. Each time an outcast population struggles for equality, the powerful and others who fear diversity and do not wish to share wealth or power attempt to squash individuals and movements responsible, usually in the names of law and order and or national security. Yet compelling the underprivileged to remain in poverty and dejection is at once volatile and ultimately calamitous to the nation. The real best and brightest are kept out, and in the end we all suffer. The imbalance that results corrupts the core of our democracy and produces mendacious mediocrity at the upper levels of power. We are governed by pious hypocrites who are mostly white males in a nation in which women are the majority and the great variety of races outnumber the entrenched status quo. Despite a departing black president and the problematic defeat of a woman candidate for the presidency, who received the popular vote, many women, blacks, Hispanics, and Asian Americans have made it into the middle level of American politics. But for the immediate present, it is obvious that a small club of white males, a minority of upper-class men, and a few suitably upper-class women strain to hold on to power, clinging desperately, defiantly, and ruthlessly to their peculiar form of country club apartheid. The practice of democracy is incomplete in its concentration on political rights without adequate attention paid to economic and social rights. In theory, everybody has an equal chance to make a buck and live the American dream in pursuit of happiness and equality. But of course, some are more equal than others in intelligence and capability, or just plain luck, or cupidity and corruption. A few of these happy fortunates share their good fortune, but the majority usually hog what they accumulate and increase it at the expense and labor of others whom they impede from sharing in the worth of their production. Such notions of inequality are dismissed as socialist or at least politically incorrect. The plutocrats who control the country's major political parties claim that the economy defines the nation more than its ideology, which is the Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights. Money is the money's ideology, they claim. What they mean by their strict interpretation of the economy is their own personal domination of the national wealth. Narrow monetary policies that singularly benefit the upper levels of society draw wealth from less well-off levels, which keeps them less well-off, and always under pressure to pay what is demanded, either through taxes or scarcity wages for their labor. Releasing public money, most of it pried from middle class and blue collar labor, to business and the wealthy elite is considered sound investment and essential to the economy. Feeding the poor, or providing them adequate shelter and medical care, or even educating them, is regarded as uneconomical and a drain on the national treasury. Candidates of the political parties appeal to the masses for their votes, but usually serve the minority at society's upper end. It is not entirely the fault of office seekers that the system is tilted toward the top. Elites take root in every society and wield disproportionate power unless a counterbalance restrains them. In a democracy, that force of resistance is constitutionally the power of ordinary people. Political parties are formed to reflect and channel the passions of ordinary people and publicly represent them fairly, efficiently, and powerfully, in theory at least, with a minimum of corruption and disruption. The two-party system fails in this purpose. It is too exclusive and compressed, and it eliminates too many people and ideas from the process of governance. The parties in reality serve politicians and their favored patrons rather than the voters. reflecting the world at large, which is generally divided into rich and poor nations. Politics in the United States are an ever-widening bicameral separation between haves and have-nots, with the Democratic Party accumulating a disproportionate membership of the impoverished and otherwise politically disenfranchised. Unfortunately, a major defection to the Republican Party of its traditional alt-white Southern membership, plus an increasing elitism of a middle class, also white, members, has tremendously diluted its reputation as a party of working people and minorities. The Democratic Party has traditionally, although reluctantly and always narrowly, encompassed a mixed variety of ideas, philosophies, and cultural styles that would otherwise find expression in other parties, which generally have little chance against the prevalent two-party system. Jammed uncomfortably into this single political party alongside a now virtually vanished core of strict constructionalists are liberals, leftists, trade unionists, environmentalists, minority groups, feminists, and others who might be regarded as free thinkers and heretics. The degeneration of the Democratic Party leaves a black hole in the center of American politics. The party's own center has fallen out, deserted to the Republican super party and to its own hubris, leaving disenfranchised minorities clinging to a disintegrating corona. Perhaps like the Soviet Communist Party, its ruins should be abandoned and the surviving fragments reconstituted into a new party, as in Russia, or into a multitude of parties that might at least reflect the disparate new majorities that have moved into American electorate, but have so far not gained real or representative power. The creation of a new political party or a spawn of parties might have disruptive effects, a worst-case scenario being a civil war such as occurred when Republicans replaced the moribund Whig Party and happened in Russia's new republics whose multiple births ripped apart the Soviet womb. The risks here at home are tremendous, yet the American political apparatus needs real change, which is not being provided by an antiquated two-party system that is developed to represent only a privileged minority. The real purpose of the American experiment is that human beings should be able to coexist as equals, not necessarily in wealth or advantage, but in basic rights and liberties, and equally share in power, and that none should be denied any of these, whatever their wealth or advantage. The word revolution causes tremors through the political culture, except when it is used to huckster a new commercial product. It was through revolution that the nation came into being. Actually, a painful splitting off of a colony from its mother government. The primary reason was an angry response to the same kind of repressive impotence that is present today. Change disrupts, and the changes that are necessary to redistribute the power and control of the nation's wealth to a majority of the people who have provided it will be dramatic and unsettling. There will not be an instant transfer of power, nor will it ever be complete. And that was something I wrote, small d, democracy. And now, to change a bit of course, an interregnum. 50 years ago tomorrow, January 27th, 1967, three American astronauts burned to death in their space capsule. They were preparing for a space flight when the capsule suddenly caught fire and they were unable to escape. Their names were Gus Grissom, Edward White, who had earlier made the first spacewalk, and Roger Chaffee. The next day, 19 years later, on January 28, 1986, the U.S. space shuttle Challenger blew up just after launch from Cape Kennedy, as Cape Canaveral was known then, which killed seven astronauts, one of whom was a school teacher who was to connect with American school children while orbiting Earth. Her name was Christy McAuliffe. The others were Judith Resnick, Dick Scobie, Michael Smith, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, and Gregory Jarvis. And on February 1st, 2003, the space shuttle Columbia burned up re-entering Earth's atmosphere after a couple of weeks in space orbiting the planet. The seven astronauts who perished were Rick Husband, Michael Anderson, Kalapana Chawla, William McCool, Laurel Clark, and Jan Ramon. Add to those deaths the first generation of American astronauts who are dead or dying. The last man on the moon, Gene Cernan, died 10 days ago on January 6th, and the second man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, was evacuated from Antarctica a few weeks ago with severe pains. The first man on the moon, Scott Armstrong, died a few years ago. John Glenn died last year. I might also add to the roll call the first generation of Russian cosmonauts. I wrote an article inspired by the Challenger spectacular explosion, which might compete in its repetitive showings on television with the hundreds of times we all saw the hijacked jet airliners crash into the World Trade Center in 2001. I wrote it for the February 1986 issue of the North Coast Times Eagle, which I am guilty of repetitive broadcasting on this radio program with several rewrites, the most recent in December 2015 on the occasion of the 112th anniversary of powered flight. This time, I go back to the original. I call it Stardust. We burst out of our egg into a history infinitely larger than our own, flung out among rocks and stars that hurtle away from the center of a cataclysm at speeds greater than light. Our Earth is a mote from that moment of creation, if indeed that is how the universe began, and it continues to be thrown back to God knows where. We might never know, but we will exhaust the rest of our history attempting to find out. It is doubtful that we will more than scratch a few score of the billion stars in our single galaxy before evolution discards us for something else, or we quicken the process by our own pervasive ingenuity. We pursue the exploration of space in much the manner our European ancestors forced themselves upon the larger world, in fierce competition as merchants and soldiers from separate nations in perpetual conflict. We are a species of insatiable plunderers, though of course we tell ourselves that we are not, that we seek only knowledge, but our great hunger is for wealth and for what is useful to us. Unless we experience a mass epiphany overnight, we will most likely behave beyond the ozone the same as our predecessors beyond the oceans. We will pillage planets and hammer and smash space matter until it is functional. We have virtually sucked Earth dry, and our vision of the universe is one of a huge orchard of riches. We cover our own planet like maggots on a peach. Our atomic structure is collapsing, and internal combustion resulting from the compost of our restless numbers. We are perilously close to extinction by our own industry. Not so long ago, we were savages tormented by our ignorance of the strange world that was our home. We have not evolved particularly much, except that our savagery is more muscular and technological. We have the power to crack Earth. Our situation as a result of possessing that power is desperate. If we cannot contain its power over us, Earth will probably nova. Our prospects are the stuff of cheap science fiction. Our only hope might be to send some seedlings off the home planet so that some might survive the long nuclear winter and perhaps repopulate the incubator when it stops glowing or germinate somewhere else, if in all the vast cosmos there is any place else for us. We repeat the old errors. We do not leave Earth as members of a single bioplasm, but as relentless opponents. If it was absurd for Europeans to spread across the Earth's oceans and claim foreign lands for kings and countries never heard of by the inhabitants of the far shores, how much more for space-suited humans to plant flags on barren worlds and say that they belong in perpetuity to small parts of a rocky speck, indistinguishable, if even visible, among the lights of space? Now that we are having second thoughts about the American space program because of the deaths of seven astronauts, which included a schoolteacher, we ought to consider the United Nations as a central agency for space exploration. It would avoid the wasteful duplication of resources and money consumed by the ruthless competition between superpowers and make them available for the millions of Earthlings who are in need of food, housing, and education. If the idea seems outworldly, it might be useful to remember that UN medical teams eradicated smallpox. Of course, the governments of the United States and the Soviet Union would try to prevent the idea from germinating because it will interfere with their individual plans of military supremacy beyond Earth. The irony about all this is the intent to freeze the international exchange of scientific information during the space age, the polarization of intellect and the resurgence of nationalism at the same time we set out to explore the universe. We should not get starry-eyed about the professed manifest destiny of our own nation and its parochial space program. Many of the planned shuttle flights were to be secret military missions, primarily to do with Star Wars. And we should be cautious about the elevation of the seven dead space explorers into mythical figures. We should not allow them to be so wrapped in the flag that it is considered unpatriotic to question the circumstances that killed them. Their deaths might help save humanity. The failure of the technology that was to propel them into space failed at the critical moment. The merely technical questions pale before the major one of our dependence upon the same systems that threaten us with oblivion to save us. Efficiency must give way to poetry. No machine or computer can view Earth with the same personal response as a human. Earth is, after all, our neighborhood, our nest. It will not be our technology which saves us, but our distinct human perceptions. The efforts to go off-planet seem to have little to do with the rest of day-to-day humanity, yet our era makes the first baby steps of an adventure that will occupy us the rest of our time in the cosmos. We might be the last generations to be a single-planet species. One world history and philosophy will be mere prelude to the immense galactic story that awaits our bumbling, erratic first paragraph. An age is superseding an earlier one under our feet, or more truthfully, over our heads. And perhaps it might be worth remembering that it is not our divine right to eat the Milky Way. And that was something I wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle in February 1987. And I'd like to finish the program with a poem by Lauren Goodman, Poem for the Government. I'm writing some poems for the government, but I can't talk about them now. I can't talk at all. The writing has been going well, on schedule, and all expenses have been taken care of. I'm not at liberty to discuss the secretive nature of my work, which demands that I write in silence and disgust and under an assumed name. My work for the government is not only confidential, it is gross, exquisite. Many lives hang in the balance. I'm also writing some poems that aren't for the government, but now those seem about nothing at all. I don't know where or how my poems will be used, but I want them to be foolish and deadly. That I write in silence and seclusion and under this parasol for the government, my tiny son at my feet, makes me extremely poetic. I think of splashes and hear the poems I am writing in this paradise, one of which is really for you. I include it in the government batch, perhaps to better include you in our lives. And that was Poem for the Government by Lauren Goodman. And Cycle of Freedom. Sir Alec Fraser Tyler, a 19th century Scottish historian, claimed that great civilizations run in 200-year cycles, taking in the same path to the top and back. A contemporary American, Jim DeMint, devised a graph around Tyler's idea, the cycle of freedom, which starts and ends with bondage. Bondage, spiritual faith, great courage, liberty, abundance, selfishness, complacency, apathy, dependency, bondage, etc. Go back to go. DeMint insists the cycle can be broken if America wakes up, he says. And this has been Michael McCusker.